Good afternoon and welcome once again. It's Eric Scott on WASR. Friday, and not soon enough as far as I'm concerned. But, all right, how's everything going? Good? Looking out the window, seeing some pretty heavy snow out there. However, we're not supposed to get a whole lot of it. 1 to 3 is the projection at this point, even though when I left for work this morning outside my house, I already had about 2 inches. It's Friday, and that means, once again, that we have Jeb Bradley, a New Hampshire State Senator, Majority Leader, and Wolfboro resident. Senator, thanks for being with us.
How are you today?
I am very well. It looks like, I don't know. Is this good weather? Is this good for hiking, or is this not good for hiking?
I don't think it'd be a great day above tree line because, you know, you don't want to lose the trail. You don't want to get off, you know, where you're going. And, I've been in conditions like this above tree line, but it's not advisable.
I wouldn't think
so. It's not that it's that cold today, but visibility is pretty important. Depending on how much wind and blowing snow, that can be kind of a pain. And when you're above tree line, what happens is the cairns, which are your trail markers, which are really important in the winter, it's hard to tell what they are. If they're mounds of rock, if they're cairns, if they're trees covered by snow. And so if you can't see more than 100 feet, you may not be able to see a cairn anyway. You got to know it's a cairn, and you can get off trail fairly easily, so it's not advisable. But below tree line, yes, I love hiking in the snow. You just need the proper gear, and it's quiet, and the trails are softer. Generally, you would be using snowshoes. So I like it. It depends on how much.
Right.
2 inches is nice and easy. 2 feet, you need a big group of people and a lot of young, strong legs as opposed to geezers like me.
Yeah. And it's, by the way, did you get your shot?
Not yet. I'm the end of March.
Oh, the end of March. Well, I'm the 18th of March. Hopefully now that, vaccine production is ramping up, maybe we'll get bumped up a little bit, but. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I know that people are getting calls to come in earlier. Several people have called me up and with health conditions that they really should jump to the head of the line. They're over 65 and they have pre-occurring conditions, whatever they may be, and there were several people that just had a bit of a hard time navigating it. So they were the end of March, even into April. And I got one couple moved up, last Saturday at Walgreens of Wolfboro, which is, a new open. So, if people are in that kind of circumstance, I'd urge them to give me a shout and I'll see what I can do.
Okay. Today, I thought there were some various bills that have been working their way through the Senate, and I guess you were involved with some of these bills, and I'd like to talk to you about them, if that's okay.
Sounds good to me.
All right. First one is SB 61, prohibiting collective bargaining agreements that require you to join a union.
So that's the right to work.
Okay. This has been around for a while.
It's been a bill that's been debated as long as I've been in the legislature. It's passed the Senate several times. It's had a much more difficult go of it in the House. We'll see what happens. We passed it 13 to 11. I think it was last week. And, it's in the House now. So, again, we'll see what happens. I think the opponents of right to work claim that it's going to undermine unions, and I would argue that that's not the case. Obviously, everybody's entitled to their opinion. But with a recent Supreme Court decision in 2018, basically it said right to work applies for all public sector unions everywhere in the country now. And it hasn't impacted, you know, the strength and the breadth of public sector unions anywhere in the country. What it does say is that you can't coerce membership and you don't have an exclusive right to bargain on behalf of those employees, which is something that unions have requested, that they have exclusive bargaining rights. And of course, then, you know, they've argued with those exclusive bargaining rights, even if the individual member is not a member of the union and doesn't want the union negotiating on his or her behalf, the union does so, and then they expect what are called so-called agency fees. And so that's where the, you know, the rubbers come in. But again, you know, one of the arguments I made when we debated right to work is that this 2018 Supreme Court decision called Janus has not upended public sector unions at all. And I don't think the same would be true if we passed, you know, so-called right to work for private sector unions, which 28 other states have. And those states have generally enjoyed, you know, much faster economic growth, higher wage growth, and people are moving to those states. So is it an economic panacea for New Hampshire if we became a right-to-work state? No, I wouldn't say that, but it's one more thing that would make us attractive, especially in the Northeast, where we'd be the only right-to-work state anywhere in the Northeast. And I think, you know, where we're in a very competitive environment, at least in the other states, for attracting businesses and workers, this would be helpful. Obviously, you know, the officials who run, you know, unions see it differently, and they feel that, you know, right to work undermines unions, and that by, if that happens, it weakens, you know, worker protection. But I just don't see it that way, I guess, because of the fact that in the right to work states, you still have, you know, strong unions, but you also have better economic growth and better wage growth. And I think that's what we should be aspiring to, and I think it would help our state.
Well, I have curiosity. If you have, say, 30 people in your bargaining unit and 10 don't join the union, they get the same benefits that the union members get. And I'm sure you've heard this argument before about 5,000 times.
And that is the argument that opponents of right to work use. But the countervailing point to that is that when unions become chartered, they demand exclusive bargaining rights. So my view is if people voluntarily want to join the union, pay the dues, and expect the union to bargain for them, that's all good if that's what the individual is choosing to do. On the other hand, if the individual does not want to join the union and does not want the union negotiating for them, they should be free to have that choice. And that's where the rub comes. The unions have demanded that exclusive bargaining power. So, I mean, that exclusive representation of their employees. And I, you know, is that, you know, would you want somebody that you didn't want negotiating for you? I mean, I think it comes down to that. And then they expect, you know, to be paid for. So the so-called freeloader argument needs to be judged in the context of the fact that unions have demanded exclusive bargaining rights over the members of the union.
Okay, I'm still a little funny. Then who else would bargain for those people?
Well, if I work for Company X and I'm an individual, and Company X has a union, but I'm not a member of the union, and I want to bargain myself, I bargain myself. And that's what the right is.
I see. Okay. It is 12:12 here on WASR. My name is Eric Scott. We're talking with Jeb Bradley, who is the New Hampshire Senate Majority Leader and lives right here in Wolfboro. And he's going to leave a little bit early again because of another meeting. I'm sure you put in a very full day, Senator. Next one is House Bill 430. And this is interesting. Repealing the prohibition on being adjacent to a reproductive care facility. As a First Amendment champion, I didn't know that's troubling that we had such a prohibition.
So hang on, I'm trying to pull that piece of legislation up right now as we speak. Whoops, wrong icon. Sorry about that.
That's all right. What did we ever
do? Why don't you go on to the
computers?
Next one? Maybe I'll recognize
okay.
it right off the bat.
All right. This is one that was interesting that I actually read the bill. Senate Bill 38, Alternative Treatment Centers,
okay.
that they can form LLCs and stuff.
Yep.
Why couldn't they do that before?
So the way the law was written, we authorized, these are for medical marijuana.
Yes.
And we authorized, I think there were four, and it's now been expanded to six with a couple of satellite locations, these treatment centers, so that you can purchase, if you have, you know, a medical marijuana card issued by, you know, a physician that says the condition that you have could be assisted by medical marijuana. Okay, so you get that. It's not a prescription. It's just that authorization. You have the card. You go to the treatment center. You buy the medical marijuana. When that law passed 7 or 8 years ago, and it was really pretty contentious, there was a prohibition built into the law that they could not be for profit. They had to be not for profit. So 7 or 8 years later, the issue that we've had is that the not for profit therapeutic treatment centers, they can't raise equity financing. And so their cost to do business is higher as a result, which is reflected in higher price of therapeutic marijuana. Okay. So the hope is that by allowing those entities that already were licensed as of January 1st, 2021, to become, should they choose to, and should it be approved by the Attorney General's office, to become for-profit, then the different financing arrangements that are out there for equity type of capital could help lower the cost of the therapeutic marijuana. So we haven't, like, legalized marijuana. We haven't changed those laws there. It's really just about whether the treatment center is organized as a for-profit or a not-for-profit entity.
Okay. One of the things, a large number of complaints I've heard about alternative treatment centers is that they don't take credit cards. Now, I realize that's not something that you can do much about, but I'm always wondering why that's such a problem. And I've heard about it all over the country.
And the reason I think for that is that because marijuana is federally prohibited,
right.
it flies into banking regulations in terms of how payment can happen, so it has to be in cash. That is my understanding.
Okay. If you have a question, by the way, for the senator, we'll be happy to take that for you. 569-5253. That's 569-LAKE.
Pull up that other. Give me that number again.
Yep.
Was it House Bill 432?
430.
430. Okay. So let's see here.
It has to do with, like I said, it's, repealing prohibition on being adjacent to a reproductive care facility.
Okay. So, this is a First Amendment issue. And should people be able to congregate around an abortion clinic and they can't interfere with somebody being able to go in and out, but should they be able, do they have a First Amendment right to protest? It's kind of meaningless right now. New Hampshire law says they don't have that right. Federal law, and it was a unanimous decision 4, 5, 6 years ago by the United States Supreme Court that says people do have that right within, you know, a certain distance. I mean, they can't be like right on top of people going into, you know, the clinic, but certainly they can be outside the clinic, you know, and holding signs and things like that. But the U.S. Supreme Court held that they have that right to peacefully, you know, protest. New Hampshire law, on the other hand, prohibited that, and this bill, House Bill 430, would be to make, you know, New Hampshire law consistent with federal law.
Okay, so this is really what they call pro forma, because after the Supreme Court has spoken, the law couldn't be enforced anyway.
That's correct.
Okay. I did get a text from a gentleman who would like me to ask you a question on right to work, if that's okay.
Sure.
He says, right to work, on average, reduces worker earnings 2 to 4%. Less likely to be offered benefits, shortcuts in worker safety, just to name a few. Now, I do know that the person does or is a member of the union, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, look, the you know, statistics that I've seen would indicate that states that are right to work have better job growth and growing wages. So that's what I've seen. And you know what? I'm going to try to find the document that I'm referring to. It was a 2018, you know, study of the, I think at that time there were 27 right to work states, not 28. But, you know, that's, you know, and look, people see it differently. I understand that, but I, you know, tried to go to where the facts are. I've always supported it on a principled basis, but I think that, you know,
do you think
I'm trying to find it here.
Do you think this is why all the car manufacturers have located down south, because there are generally right-to-work states and not really pro-union as much as some other states?
Yeah, and that's a pretty major factor. All right, so the study I'm citing is NERA, N-E-R-A, Economic Consulting. It was a 2018 study in May, written by Dr. Jeffrey Eisenbach, who is a PhD. Okay, so let me just hit some of the highlights in the study. Private sector employment grew by 27% in right-to-work states between 2001 and 2016, compared to 15% in non-right-to-work states. Okay. Further, right-to-work right-to-work laws do not lead to lower average wages in either unionized or non-unionized industry. And it goes on to say there is some evidence that the long-run effect of right-to-work laws is to raise wages, raise wage rates as a result of increased productivity. And then another one, higher growth rates, and that's jobs is what he's referring to, translated into higher personal income. Personal income in right-to-work states rose over 10 percentage points more than in non-right-to-work states between 2001 and 2016, 39% versus 26%. So, I mean, you know, that's, I'd like to think, a good justification for why New Hampshire should be a right-to-work state.
All right, that's a great answer. Thank you very much, Senator. Next one, we've been hearing about this one for a couple of days. I wanted to ask you about it. Education Freedom Accounts, which is House Bill 20, named after Mr. Hinch, I believe.
Yep.
What can you tell me about those?
Yeah, so Dick Hinch, who was the newly elected speaker in December, who died only a few days after being elected, had filed that legislation as Speaker of the House. For education freedom accounts. What they do is the money, the adequacy payment, about $3,700 that the state pays for every child to go to school in New Hampshire would follow the child, not the school. So, you know, if you're a parent that's homeschooling, right now you're paying your property taxes to the school, but any of the assistance that would go is not going to you. And the same for other private schools or charter schools, or although charter schools do get an independent stipend. So it's intended to follow the child. And I think that, you know, especially given the pandemic and the drop in enrollment that we've seen and the fact that more and more people are looking for alternatives, that this is a concept that should be explored. Now, what happened in the House is that the bill was held over for further study, and that happened yesterday. There are some amendments that were being proposed that would cap the stipend to parents. I believe it was at $99,000 of income or less. So that would have shrank the pool of eligible students by about 50%, but it would also have targeted the more needy kids that really don't have the options that parents that have a higher income level have. That may well be something that, you know, should be considered when this bill, you know, gets looked at in the fall, which is what will happen. The Senate also has a companion bill. And that's, you know, something that we'll consider when it comes up. I don't believe, and this is the same argument, you know, as charter schools, that education freedom accounts are going to undermine public education. I think that obviously there'll have to be some adjustments. How many families will use them remains to be seen. I think most families are going to send, you know, their kids to the public school, the vast majority will. But for, you know, the kids that need something different, and the same argument that I made many times on your show, Eric, about charter schools, this is gives, especially if it's targeted to low and middle income families, just gives more opportunities to kids that need the opportunities the most. And I think that, you know, during the pandemic, we have seen that kids and their parents need options. So we'll see what happens. It's controversial, no question about it. I get that. I don't think it's going to undermine public schools. I think, you know, it will just enhance the ability for parents and kids to have a good education.
I know that this subject has been of great interest to you in the charter schools. I know you've worked very hard on it. Would the union bill, SB 61, would that prohibit unions in charter schools?
No, nothing in Senate Bill 61 prohibits a union. What it prohibits is mandatory membership and dues being paid, or what are called agency fees, which are the cost of negotiating for. There's nothing in right to work that prevents a union. It just prevents enforcement of membership or dues.
Isn't that what they used to call fair share? I think.
You know what? You got me on that one, okay. Eric. I don't know.
Well, I have another text, and I'd like to get a comment on this one. The Center for American Progress, and I'm not ruling on the accuracy of this, says right to work has failed to increase employment growth in 23 states. Now, I don't know, whether this is accurate or not. You probably know more about it than I do. However, you would think that a right to work state would be more attractive to employers rather than less.
I'll go back to, some of the data that I talked about, on the floor. Michigan and Indiana, which are two of the more latter states, to pass right to work, saw significant factory payroll growth after they implemented it. Michigan's unemployment rate fell by 4.8% after passage. Wisconsin had one of the best decades in terms of job growth in 10 years, since after they passed right to work, 50,000 new jobs were added. And then in Kentucky, 100,000 new jobs are added after passing right to work. So I think, and that's just the, more recent states. And I go back to, one of the statistics that I cited in the NERA report. I'll read it again. Private sector employment grew 27% in right-to-work states between 2001 and 2016, compared to 15% in non-right-to-work states. So I think the evidence is pretty clear that right-to-work has led to better job growth.
Well, and again, that's kind of what it would make sense, but I don't know. So let's move on from there. It's 12:29. Thank you very much for listening to WASR today. This one's an interesting one. I don't know if you know much about it or not, but House Bill 345 wants to establish licensing for mushroom harvesting. Was that the day that the New Hampshire House solved every other problem on the planet?
All right, so House Bill 345.
Yep, House Bill 345, relative to licenses for mushroom harvesting.
All right.
No, I realize that, you eat the wrong mushroom and something terrible can happen to you. I understand.
Yeah, so obviously, I believe this is, I'm looking at it, it's a license for harvesters and distributors. And so it really is meant to tag people, not if you want to go out and harvest mushrooms yourself, but if you're, selling them, distributing them, and somebody who has occasionally harvested mushrooms, my brother is, who lives in out west, and he used to live in Washington State, I've gone with him before, just unbelievable mushrooms that we harvested. But let me just say that there are a lot of bold, B-O-L-D, mushroom pickers, and there are a lot of old mushroom pickers, but there are not many old and bold mushroom pickers. So having a license for people that are distributing, selling to the public, I don't have a problem with.
It just doesn't seem like something that a Republican would support, but I understand it because, as you're right, so that doesn't mean that the individual person needs a license.
That's not my reading of it, no.
Okay. I got one more for you. 304, House Bill 304, is a study on the tuition and transportation for career technical education. Yeah, education. That's what it says. I can't read my own writing. And I thought that was interesting because technical education seems to be, or more the other way, it seems to be not enough people are taking technical education courses, and there's shortages of nurses and teachers and plumbers and auto mechanics and all of these things. It's very hard to get people to fill those jobs.
Yeah, and I'm a co-sponsor of this bill. I mean, Representative Ladd of Upper Grafton County Haverhill, I think, is the sponsor of it. So it's Glenn Cordelli locally. I think, you know, we need to make sure that we're enhancing options for people with higher education. And I believe that university education, while it's certainly good for a lot of people, has maybe been oversold to a certain extent in this country, whereas technical education through our community colleges, which, you know, do a great job, I think, of training people to be nurses or auto mechanics or, you know, who knows, and welders, I mean, any number of things. I think we need, you know, more, not less, of that kind of opportunity for kids in New Hampshire. I think that, you know, one of the big takeaways in Governor Sununu's budget is his call for the university and the community college systems to merge. That would, it would do a couple of things, but I think, you know, by having one unified board and administrative costs being, I think it would make things more efficient in terms of, you know, procurement of supplies and the ability to negotiate just on that level. I would hope it would lead to less overhead. But I also hope that in the, you know, in the details, and the devil is always in the details, that it really enhances the community colleges in New Hampshire and not sort of allows the University of New Hampshire to control the community colleges. Because I think, you know, the community colleges have done a really good job of, you know, providing that kind of technical skill education for people that need it at a much, much, much lower cost to students. And they, you know, the student debt issue and, you know, all of those things. I mean, I think, you know, universities have become wildly expensive, and they've sold themselves as absolutely necessary to people, and not everybody benefits from, you know, university education. And if you're paying for it with student loans, you know, that can really be an encumbrance on people for a long, long time. And, you know, the fact that people are paying for that education with student loans has really allowed universities, I'm not talking about, you know, New Hampshire per se, but just in general, to raise their prices and, you know, just become cost prohibitive. And then people that go through these universities are just stuck with a bill. And so I think some of the lessons, if you will, that the community college has brought to New Hampshire in terms of doing it cost effectively and without the bureaucracy would stand the university system well in this combination.
What about bringing some of those skills back into high schools? When I went to high school, back when they, you know, they had the school bus dinosaur, we had three tracks. You could be on a college track, a business track, or a technical education track. And we had, you know, there were small engine repair, which I failed in high school, I will admit, because I'm just not cut out for that kind of thing.
And that's why you're on radio. Right,
right, exactly, because I couldn't fix a lawnmower. But, you know, you can introduce people to those kind of things. There was a beautician course there. There were early childhood development. There were a lot of things that, you know, my school had that I realize are tough to justify when, you know, you don't have enough books to go around. But would that investment be worthwhile, in your opinion, for our kids? Maybe to give them an idea of what's out there for technical education?
Yeah, for instance, at Kingswood you have, you know, the technical education opportunity, and a lot of the high schools do. And I think that's a really good thing. I mean, look, we need more healthcare workers in New Hampshire, especially nurses and, you know, mental health counselors and things that don't necessarily require 4 years of medical school on top of college. And, you know, we need more plumbers and we need more electricians. And, you know, so an education system that really provides those kind of opportunities and does so at a cost basis that is much more affordable for kids is very important, I think, to New Hampshire. So I think, you know, it's one of those things that the governor is pretty forward-thinking on, and you know, look to see how it works.
Okay. What else is coming down the pike as far as what you're working on and during or for the next Senate session?
So the good news is, and we've spoken about this before, my broadband matching grant bill has cleared its first hurdle.
Good for you.
In the Senate committee, voted unanimously, you know, to recommend the full Senate adopt it. So I would expect that'll be on the calendar in March, early March. I think what will happen is it will then get sent to the Finance Committee, and we will hopefully include it in the budget with an appropriation. So, you know, that's something I've been working on. I think that another bill that, you know, I've worked on a lot with the police chiefs, you know, hasn't been voted on yet, but I feel pretty confident that it'll do well in the Judiciary Committee. There's been a big effort over the last 3 or 4 years to reform our bail system so that people with less means, more modest income, have the same opportunity to get bail as people of, you know, more significant means.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that even with the best intentions, the way it was written, the way it was implemented, had led to violent, you know, people having been accused of a crime, arrested for a crime, to get bail right away and then go out and, you know, commit more crimes. So we need to rein that back in. I've been working with the police chiefs to do that, and I believe that is likely to pass. I think, you know, public safety is a huge issue, and we're seeing crime waves in many cities around the country, in many areas of the country, and, you know, I think the last thing that we should be doing is undermining, you know, law enforcement. And so this is a way, I think, to, you know, bring the balance back to where it should be.
We have a few minutes left, and I have one more bill to talk about, if you don't mind. This is Senate Bill 2, pre-processing of absentee ballots, which kind of makes sense to me to have that all counted by Election Day.
So we authorized those provisions for the November 2020 election. But we didn't go any further. We authorized sort of a no-fault absentee. In other words, normally you're supposed to either be ill or not be available to vote, to be able to vote by absentee. But for the 2020 fall election, because of the pandemic, we made absentee voting without, you know, having to be out of state. It worked well. New Hampshire has, I think, pretty rigorous controls still in place, although I would like to see better signature matching. At least in New Hampshire, to get an absentee ballot, you had to request it. And we didn't have, you know, the general mail-in voting problem that a lot of other states had. So I think, you know, our election has been clean and transparent. Not everybody liked the results, obviously, but that always happens in an election. There's a winner and there's a loser.
Right.
But I think that our process was good. So we did allow that, and we did allow absentee ballots because there were more of them to be, you know, counted earlier in the day, and it seemed to work well. So what Senate Bill 2 does is authorize those provisions for town meetings. It's a temporary authorization. It ends, I believe, on August 1st of this year. So we would revert back to, you know, the system in place before the pandemic, which I think is also appropriate. You know, I think a high priority for all of us in Concord is to make sure that our elections are clean and honest. The people that live in New Hampshire, that are residents of New Hampshire, that are eligible to vote in New Hampshire, there are no impediments. But at the same time, that we have the safeguards in place to make sure that it's people that are supposed to and eligible to vote in New Hampshire that vote in New Hampshire, and not you know, people that are not eligible. And so absentee signature matches, that's a good thing. And I think that's something we're going to be pushing this year. Enhancing our residency requirements, I think that's something that is really necessary. So these, you know, reforms building upon, you know, what we passed 7 or 8 years ago, which is showing a voter ID when you go to vote, you know, that is a reform that I think most people support. And the people that don't support it are probably looking to, you know, get around the system. We're always accused of voter suppression for things like that, but nothing could be further from the truth. It's really to ensure clean elections. Now, the one thing I will say, because it was an issue that, you know, has really come up over the last few weeks, is what happened in the town of Windham, you know, which is in southern New Hampshire, when there was a recount. The losing candidate was within about 25 votes of the, it was a multi-person district, so there was 25 votes that separated the winner from the loser, and there was a recount, and in the recount, 300 votes roughly went to the Republican side, all of the candidates, and the Democratic candidates lost 100 votes, so that was a pretty big swing, and nobody knows exactly what happened. So we passed a bill yesterday that calls for an audit of the Windham vote results, both recounting of the ballots and running them through the machines. And the Attorney General's office would do that with this authorization. It absolutely has to happen. But as I've said to a lot of different people over the last couple of weeks, I did not see and don't believe there was a systemic voting machine problem in New Hampshire. And while our voting machines, which are older in New Hampshire, are owned now by the company that there's been some controversy about, these machines are older, they're not connected to the Internet, and not hackable, according to the Secretary of State. Now, I also saw with my own eyes three separate Senate recounts in District 9, 11, and 12, all in more southwestern New Hampshire. District 9's Bedford was a 400-vote margin. The Republican won. District 11, which is Amherst and Merrimack and Milford, which was a 200-vote margin. The Republican won. And then District 12, which is Brookline, Hollis, parts of Nashua stretching out to New Ipswich, which the Republican won. All three recounts upheld the ballot count on the night of the election. And what happens in these recounts, and they're about 35,000 votes in each one. They took a day each. There are about 10 tables where the Secretary of State staff put each and every ballot on a camera that is hooked into a monitor. And people sit at tables surrounded by a lot of watchers. And so you have a Democrat and a Republican sitting right next to each other watching each vote count. And they go into a stack, Republican or Democrat. And so There were times that I was at the table. There were times I was sitting right behind the people at the table for 3 days. And as each ballot flips through, your eye goes to the race that you're watching. But, you know, it takes about a second to 2 seconds to flip each ballot. And so you get a chance to look. Biden Trump or Shaheen Messmer or Pappas Mowers, whatever it was. And I came away convinced that, you know, the election in New Hampshire, having sat through these three recounts, three Senate districts, that's 1/8 of the state, roughly, and 100,000 ballots. Now, I didn't see all 100,000 because there were 8 tables, I believe, in, you know, going at the same time. But I saw enough to be convinced that, you know, there was not a systemic machine problem in New Hampshire. Now, that's my opinion. Okay? But because of what happened in Windham, we absolutely need a full-fledged audit. And that'll happen.
Well, in a way, I think that's a good idea because it would be nice to find out exactly what happened there. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. You have a another meeting coming up, so you did tell me we're going to be a little bit short today. So thank you very much again for your time, Senator, and we'll talk next Friday.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for a great talk. Take care. It is
12:49
here on WASR, and I thank you very much for listening. So that'll just about do it for the Eric Scott Show for Friday, the 19th of February already. And snow all day. If you're going out, be careful. We don't expect a lot of snow, but probably more than we expected at this point. A forecast, of course, is on the way just after the 1 o'clock news. Here on WASR. Have a great day.